Do you wish you had a better memory? Sometimes I want to curl up in embarrassment when I meet someone I've known for years at a party, realise I've got to introduce them. This is... And no name comes to mind. Wouldn't it be wonderful to get help? A whisper in the ear, even?
Well, the nomenclator was, in Roman times, the person who went round telling the senator who they were meeting, so the namesayer.
Computer scientist Wendy Hall wants to revive an ancient solution.
And the nomenclator was the person who did this for the senators, going round the Senate, this is Senator so-and-so, and this is his wife, Ophelia, whatever. We think that quite soon we'll be able to develop a technology that will be some combination of hearing aid and glasses that will actually, if I've forgotten your name, it will say to me, this
Fantastic.
Is Susan Blackmore.
Now, excellent.
And I really think that a memory aid, which is what it is really, like you've got glasses to help you with the eyesight as it goes, and you've got a hearing aid. We really think within the next 5 to 10 years you'll be able to buy memory aids.
Are you glad to be living in an age when you think within your lifetime you'll have these memory aids?
Yeah, I think so. I would like to have them before I really need them, yeah. And I'm beginning to think I need one now, actually.
And I certainly need one, and a lot of other memory aids besides. Seems a great idea to me. Unproblematic and helpful. Bring it on fast. But maybe I'm ignoring existing memory aids and the way they are already changing our memories.
I don't think any of us remember cell phone numbers at this point. Those numbers are in the cell phone. The cell phone remembers those things, and you're quite happy to delegate phone numbers to a cell phone. So I used to be able to remember some large number of phone numbers. Now I make sure I don't remember any phone number because my computer has that.
Engineer Gordon Bell, one of the legendary figures in computer science. We'll be hearing more from him later. But storing numbers in mobile phones is just the start. We may be at a turning point when we suddenly have the ability to store vast amounts of information about our own lives, or maybe everything about our own lives. I want to explore how this new technology is affecting what and how we remember about ourselves. I've always been a little bit obsessed with memory, not just as a psychologist wanting to know how it works in the brain, but for myself too, wanting to preserve something of my own life. In fact, I've been downloading my personal memories to a series of prosthetic devices since I was a teenager, starting way back in 1964.
You say you will love me if I have to go.
This is my very first diary. It's in a little cardboard box which I've lovingly sellotaped with white paper all over it. All the sellotape's gone kind of orange and
written on the outside. And there are pictures of beetles, you know, the insects, but all over the place on the box. And, well, I think they're insiders. Oh, they are. And horses. Horses, toboggans, skis, and beetles all over the place. Oh, goodness me. Today I bought a beetle picture of John, and Mummy gave me one of Paul. He's my favourite.
Someday when we're dreaming, deep in love, not a lot to say, then we will remember things we said today.
Sunday, Jenny and Cabby stayed to tea, and then we played Murder in the Dark. Super.
Love is love, and though we may be blind,
I'd hate to lose these diaries. I feel I'd be losing something of myself. In some way I don't quite understand, it makes me feel happier and more secure to know that I can look up what happened or where I was on a particular day. I wish I'd started earlier.
Earliest memory. Actually, I can remember when I was in a car. We used to share a room that maybe about...
The earliest thing I can remember is my father was in bed and I was sort of prancing.
I do remember being in this little Belfast sink that my parents used to leave under the...
A memory of being in a pram and looking up through a bunch.
I remember going to school, just.
It's a World Cup final. I remember watching it with my dad and going out in the garden at half-time and replaying. So I would have been 6, 7 years old.
And I must have been about 5. But nothing very specific.
It's all hazy and uncertain, and I wouldn't bet on it.
I'm not entirely sure that I haven't convinced myself that is my earliest memory.
I don't have a reason to suppose it's true because I have a picture of it and think I remember it.
But so because I've watched it, I'm not sure if I remember it from viewing the video or it's something I actually remember.
I've asked lots of people, what is your earliest memory? Nearly everybody comes up with one, sometimes wonderfully vivid ones, but then quickly admits that it might not be true, that it might be based on a family story or on looking at photos. So we have these vivid, apparently, memories, but we know we shouldn't rely on them. What if we could? What if we could have perfect recall of everything that happened, even in infancy? Or a perfect record?
We ended up at peak time, which was probably between my son's first and second birthday, recording on average 10 hours a day. And that's 10 hours of multiple cameras and microphones being active. And then depending on how many of the 11 cameras are on, typically 5 or 6 parallel streams of video. And that has been ongoing pretty much on a continual basis for 2.5 years. So we have a total of somewhere on the order of 200,000 hours of audio and video.
Deb Roy is a computer engineer, a professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, who works in its famous media lab. In an extraordinary application of high-tech information storage, he's studying the development of children's language by collecting complete audio and video recordings of his own children's lives. He calls this the Human Speechome Project.
We have high-resolution video cameras with what are called fisheye lenses attached, so they give you omnidirectional view of a room if you mount them near or in the ceiling looking down. So we have this bird's eye view peering into a room. And we also have a very high quality microphone that is made specially to be affixed to a flat surface like a ceiling or a wall. They're used often in conference rooms so that you can pick up very clear speech from a distance. And so that pair of sensors are embedded in the ceiling of every room in our house. And then we have a controller that looks sort of the same size as a light switch. And one of the interesting things is the controller, the recording device, has 4 buttons. 2 of them let you turn audio and video on and off. And then the other 2 are essentially what we call the oops button. If you just realize you've said something or done something and you just don't want that on record, you can go and hit the oops button anywhere in the house and just punch in how many minutes back in time you want to erase permanently from the archives.
You and your wife are both speech scientists. What are the scientific questions that you're hoping might be answered?
The reason that we're starting off by transcribing the speech is so that we can take particular words, it's just any old word, the word water, the word no, the word ball, and trace its development through time. So given a transcript, we can go back and say, let's now, from the database, pull out all instances of the word water, both that were heard by my son before he was using the word and then as he started producing them. And we can, for the first time with a data set like this, with really a fine-grained microscope, look at the different contexts within which he heard words.
You said that you started this for scientific reasons, but you kind of implied that there were other reasons too. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, it is the ultimate home video system. Mm. And another angle on this from a personal point of view is that it really is augmenting my and my wife's memory of this incredible time in our life in a new way.
Do you think it's augmenting it, or is it replacing it? I mean, could it be that knowing that it's all there, somehow you think, oh, well, I don't need to remember these things. It's, you know, I can always look it up later.
Well, I certainly know that feeling from other technologies that I use to outsource memory, whether it's my computer or a notepad or what have you, or for that matter, my wife, who has a far better memory than I. So I assume if we jointly experience something, she will remember. And so I don't bother.
That's kind of you.
Yeah, yes, she agrees. You know, I'm pathetic at remembering directions, but when I drive with her, I know I'm set. And when I'm not with her, I just make sure the navigation system's on in my car because it remembers how to get to places. So sure, I think everyone can relate to the feeling of having a video camera on and saying, well, I captured that moment. Does that mean you no longer have to remember it because you know you can go back to the tape? Most of us have our weddings recorded these days. Does that mean you don't feel like you have to remember your wedding because you know it's on tape? I don't think it's quite that. I think it's in some sense that you can go back and savor the moment and reflect on certain moments in ways that you wouldn't otherwise. A lot of what happens with cameras and video recorders, most of the moments you want to capture, they happen. And then you go running, you pick up the camera, and of course, it doesn't happen again. So it does change that dynamic to just know. So when special moments happen, we often will glance up to make sure we were recording.
Blue ball, yeah.
But you said augmenting, and I wondered what you meant by it. You must have had something in mind that it was somehow making your memory better or helping you in some way.
Well, it's certainly an extension in that. Well, let me give you a concrete example. I gave a talk last year, and I thought it would be fun to include in there a little personal video clip. So I went back and pulled out the first time my son walked, where he took more than one step in sequence. And I had a very clear, I mean, that's a pretty dramatic moment for any parent. And I remember exactly where, or I should say I thought I remembered exactly how it happened. I remembered that it was in the morning, it was in the hallway, I was with my wife, and it was just such a special moment. And I went back and pulled out that clip, and when I replayed it, first of all, I had some trouble finding it because I was looking for clips in the morning. Turns out it was evening, and my son took a few steps and then dropped to his hands and knees and crawled the rest of the way to me. And I excitingly yelled out, "Ma, he just took his first steps." That's not what I call my wife. That's what I call my mother. And sure enough, you watch a bit more of the video, I go running into the kitchen with my son, and there's my mother. And I realized then that my wife was actually traveling and my mom was visiting. And that memory error didn't impress my wife nor my mother.
Deb Roy is recording all this information for the sake of his linguistics research, and yet it's clearly affecting his whole family. It's weird, in fact, rather unpleasant, I think, to imagine what it would be like to record your whole life as an adult. But surely no one would do that, would they? They would.
We basically are capturing our whole lives, or as much of our life as practical to capture, and basically putting in a hard drive or in the cloud, but it's not for public consumption, it's for our own use.
Computer engineer Gordon Bell. Over the last decade, he's probably stored more information about his own life than any individual ever in history. He's the first experimental subject for a life-logging project called My Life Bits.
Life logging or My Life Bits is really a manifesto of clearing my life of clutter, of having those bits be online and having them available so that the computer can help me remember them. It's also about potential immortality, that in fact those bits will probably be available to my children and grandchildren at some point in time.
Tell me about My Life Bits. When did that begin? When did you give it the name?
Okay. We gave it the name in about 2001. This is after I had started capturing the legacy content. That meant capturing all of the articles I had written, correspondence, including email, music, photos, essentially capturing every piece of information that could be encoded and putting them into the computer. And then at that point, estimating that during my lifetime or somebody's lifetime, that about a terabyte, that's 1,000 gigabytes or 1,000,000 megabytes of memory or a disk memory would be needed, and that that would be available in about 2008, which it is. So now terabyte hard drives are available. And so one's life can reside on a hard drive.
Okay, I'll do it on there.
So what are we looking at here?
This is a SenseCam movie of my cycling to work, and it was just so dangerous because of the buses. Let me just get a volume.
One of the key tools used by Gordon Bell was created here in Cambridge by Lindsay Williams, who has the delightful job of inventing things. While she was working for Microsoft Research, she came up with this device called a SenseCam.
A member of my family had a really bad memory and always losing their spectacles, their phones, their keys. You know, I'd find the cell phone in the washing machine. So I decided to invent a camera that would help my friend. typical example of a sense cam is it has a small black box that you wear around your neck. It's got heat sensors to detect people. It's got a very wide-angle lens which captures what your hands are doing, what your feet are doing. So this is all run on a tiny computer that will last about 23 hours on one battery charge. So you'd wear this round your neck, you'd wear it all day, and it would take interesting pictures throughout the day. For example, you meet someone and the heat's detected off the person, so you take a picture of the person. Then at the end of the day, you may have a couple of thousand recordings, and they play back very quickly. So about 2,000 pictures, say 8 hours worth, you can play back in 3 minutes.
So far, Microsoft hasn't marketed the Sense Cam, and they have no plans to do so. I must say, I've found the very idea of wearing it rather disturbing, but researchers are actually queuing up to use the 150 or so already made, and it does seem to reveal some intriguing things about human memory. The Sense Cam takes a picture automatically every 30 seconds, unless it detects a change in light or temperature when it takes extra snaps. So what it records is not under your own control. Psychologist and memory expert Professor Martin Conway says this is one reason why it works so well.
After you've worn it a couple of times, you literally don't notice. You forget you've got it on.
How much have you worn one?
I mean, I've been using it on and off for the past year, so...
And do you enjoy it?
Yeah, I do enjoy it, actually. And actually, I just am completely unconscious that I'm wearing it, so much so that when I was asked to turn it off at a recent meeting in the university, I was quite surprised.
You'd forgotten you were wearing it.
Yeah, and they seem to believe, or the dean seemed to believe, that it would actually be recording his words as well.
Only by lip reading, presumably.
Even that was of a concern to him. That's how secretive deans can be.
Over the past couple of decades, really a very short time, we've seen extraordinary technologies change ourselves and change our society, the way we think about ourselves. Mm-hmm. Most of them, I would say, we didn't predict and we didn't know were coming, and then they arrived and suddenly we're all using them. Is this going to be another one of these?
I think it will be. People are going to want to use it. And I think one of the reasons they're going to want to use it is because it's what I call cognitively compatible. It creates these images which are rather like the images we have in our memories anyway. These pictures are taken outside of your conscious control. They're from your perspective, they're visual, and importantly, they represent very short time slices of action. So if you think of a visual image you have in your memory, it's usually like a bit of a snapshot of a moment, although it's by no means a literal copy of a moment.
If lots and lots of people start wearing them, what sort of effect might this have on the whole of society? I mean, I've been thinking, would they be able to communicate with them? Would people be sharing them with other people? What do you think would happen in a whole society full of camera wearers?
Well, it already happens, actually. In the United States, there are very, very large groups of people called scrapbookers who put together pictures and letters and stories and things from their lives and then exchange scrapbooks with each other. So I suppose SenseCam will create communities of people who share their SenseCam photographs.
Well, what would those communities be like?
Well, all I can tell you is that probably one of the most boring things you can do in the world is look at somebody else's SenseCam pictures.
Yes.
But one's own pictures are, of course, fascinating.
I've been talking to people who are logging their lives and using SenseCams and all sorts of other ways of storing up masses of information about their lives. What do you think about that?
Why would they do that?
Jim McGaw is a neurobiologist specialising in memory at the University of California.
In my view, the life is for now and for the future, and we need to build on the past. That's why our memories are so important to us, but we need to use our memories in order to plan for the future, in order to cope on a daily basis. That's what memories are for, because we have an existence of about half a second. Everything else is memory.
Yes.
So that the sentence that you and I uttered a few seconds ago, if we remember them, are nothing but in our memories. And our intent now to discuss something else is nothing but a memory of a plan. So memory is us.
When I go out, it ought to detect the bright light, and will I hear it beep? When it takes picture.
Only beeps when you actually press the
button. Okay, I'm not thinking about the way it's going to be. Oh, it's a lovely bright light. But if it doesn't detect that, then it won't detect anything. Right, let's take a little walk around that funny building over there.
Having first thought the Sense Cam was a horrible idea, I'd now begun to get intrigued.
Someone riding past on a bicycle, and do you just get used to that and forget about it and not want it to take particular things?
Yeah, exactly.
So I was delighted to have the chance to try one on a quick walk around the Science Park in Cambridge with Steve Hodges from Microsoft Research.
I don't think most of our users are so excited as you initially, so that's fantastic.
But you just put it on and don't worry about it.
Oh,
it really stimulates their memory.
A wonderful fountain which is squirting out great blobs of water and then stopping. I wonder if it'll take a picture of that.
As we walked around chatting, I too began to forget about the device, but soon I wanted to see the result. It wouldn't be like having a whole day to skim through, but...
Well, can we go and have a look now at what it's taken for me?
Indeed. So if I plug this into the PC, so I can give a name to that sequence of images. I just called it Radio 3.
All right.
I can skip through some of these. Here we go.
No, that's
okay.
That's it.
So this is going. Lovely. This is going quite quickly. So here we
flip,
go through
flip,
the
flip,
through
flip,
the canteen.
Flip. Ah, that does have a different quality to it. That it was from where I was looking. It feels like yes, I remember that. I remember walking along there, and they were coming back to the front door, and we're going in again already.
So that's really interesting because from my perspective, these weren't photos taken from my point of view, but there's two things watching those that stick out that I would have, in some senses, I would have forgotten. I remember walking down the road. We walked down the pavement on that road, and the pavement was quite narrow. And I remember thinking, well, we'd be better off in the road, really, because Hugh's there with his microphone and we're trying to walk next to each other. There just wasn't a lot of space. The hedge came. And seeing that hedge triggered my memory of that, right? And I would never have ever remembered thinking we should have been walking down the middle of the road.
It triggered your own memory of a thought, an ephemeral thought that would otherwise have just gone,
didn't it? Which is associated with that whole event for me, right?
Yes.
Devices like the SenseCam seem to work because they function something like human memory. But in another way, they're still very different. A digital photo is unforgiving and inflexible compared to the subtlety and fluidity of ordinary human memory.
Semantic research.
What are you doing with the life logging?
I'm doing life logging.
Yeah. Have you got your sense cam or
something?
I don't
have a sense cam, no.
How are you logging it?
We're logging it.
At the University of Southampton, they're running a major project investigating some of the consequences of this clash. It's called Memories for Life, and it's led by computer scientist Nigel Shadbolt.
Well, I think one of the reasons a challenge like this is quite gripping and engaging is that as an area, we are all defined by our memories, and we have exquisite reference back to memories that are important to us. And I guess in my case, having lost parents in the last few years, one always wishes there was more of a record or one had a little more access to views and times and periods. Of course, the interesting thing, having said all that, as an advocate of much of this technology and interested in researching it, there seems to be something profoundly important about the ability to modify memory, reinterpret in a rather better or perhaps a different way, and indeed to forget. And I think one question to understand is the extent to which memories sometimes have to be let go.
Can you give an example of some memory that you think we'd better to let go of?
People have talked about the idea of these devices providing a form of digital presence, almost posthumous memories, bringing back to life people who have been lost to you as an individual. And the natural process by which we come to terms with loss may involve, in some sense, a softening of memory and an erosion of the hard lines of the facts. But the benefits, on the other side, are that I personally can think of occasions where having access to a little piece of experience that reinstates me to an earlier time or an interaction with a friend or a loved one is hugely valuable. Hugely valuable. And I think we're living at a very interesting transition point where the generation before us left generally a much sparser record.
Our original patient was somebody who we call Mrs. B, and she's somebody with a severe memory impairment after limbic encephalitis, which is an infection of the brain. So, for example, I went to see her in October where she lives, and she cooked a meal for me, and it was a three-course meal, and that's very important to her and her identity, that she can cook and entertain and so on. And the next morning I went back to their house, and she said to me, Emma, have I seen you recently? And I said, yes, I saw you last night. Actually, we had a lovely meal together and you cooked it for me. And she said, I have no recollection of that whatsoever. Oh. So this is...
Does it upset her terribly to be able to remember?
Yes, absolutely. It upsets her terribly.
Emma Berry is a neuropsychologist at Adam Brooks Hospital in Cambridge. She and her colleagues have been using the SenseCam to try to help elderly patients with severe memory loss. The research is in its early stages, and only a few patients have taken part so far, but the results are already dramatic.
So, say on day one, she went out on a significant event, say a trip to Lourdes and to London. Then the next day, she looked through the images. Then 2 days later, we assess her memory, and then she looked through the images again. 2 days later, we assess her memory, and she looked through the images again. And what we found is that with every time she looked through the images, her memory, when she was asked 2 days later, had improved for the
event.
What
kind of questions were you asking her for the assessment?
Free recall. This is her husband speaking to her. What do you remember about our trip to Lourdes last week? Oh, that's it. I remember we went with John and we went with Jane and we met with them. Anything else? I remember we went to a restaurant and then he'd just say anything else, anything else. He wouldn't prompt her. He'd then say, OK, this is what we did, and they'd look through the images again. 2 days later, what do you remember about our trip to London and Lourdes 9 days ago? And with every time she'd look through the images, every 2 days later, she seemed to remember more and more and more.
And what do you think's happening in the brain here? Because she's got massive damage. Is it a question of the brain is storing stuff anyway and you're helping with retrieval, or are you stimulating other parts of the brain to take over? Or do you have any theories about what's going on and how it's working?
Well, we don't really know what's going on, and that's another very good question, and these are questions that need to be answered, but we believe that she has memories stored and that she's retrieving them. And she's retrieving them because SenseCam images, certain images within SenseCam, are such powerful cues.
I should say, last year, both my parents died, one with Alzheimer's, one with vascular dementia. My mother was horrendously, absolutely violent and aggressive and didn't know who people were and screaming and shouting and throwing things around the place. My dad was sweet as anything, but just couldn't remember. And, you know, obviously I'm trying to think, well, what would it have been like for our family if they had had something to help remember?
You describe your mother, and that's very painful and very difficult, isn't it? And I think that, first of all, if she had worn SenseCam when she was younger, or you had had it when you were young, what happens is when people get Alzheimer's disease, and they start to change slowly over time, don't they? And lots of people don't have it as severely as that, and are able to carry on living with a memory impairment. But you might have been able to retain a little bit of her sense of identity, because you end up forgetting who your mother actually was.
Yes.
So I think that if it was worn by people when they are well, then that can help families to remember the person that they were, because you don't get that from still images and you don't have the time to look at video.
That's very interesting, because I've just been down at my parents' house in Devon yesterday, and now a year after my mother's died, my old mother from a long time back is beginning to come back. Mm. And now I'm beginning to remember things from much further back, which is much happier.
And what is it that's causing you to remember?
I think it's the fading. I think it's the sort of equalising. Now that a memory from a year ago, it's not so different from a memory from 3 years ago, I can remember all of those. Mm. And old memories of her coming back, which is odd, because now, of course, I'm sad. I'm becoming more sad now, because I'm remembering the night. Yeah, it was such a relief when she first died that I wasn't really sad. I was just kind of stunned. Now that the old memories of my dear mother, as she was a long time ago, are coming back, I realize I've lost who I've lost from a long time ago. So when you're saying that about if she'd had the SenseCam throughout, we might all have been able to keep a connection with the person that she was before.
Exactly.
Before she became that bad.
Yes, exactly. And wouldn't you want your children to remember you in the way that you are now, rather than in the way that, you know, if you became very ill and violent and aggressive and so on.
Mm.
But the other thing that you said there that's very interesting is what psychologists often try to say, is that forgetting is important. It's important that you forget that aspect of your mother, because that wasn't really your mother, that was her disease, and that's how she became. And your mother doesn't want to be remembered in that way. So that's, you know, forgetting for you is a very important thing.
Who really was my mum then? And how should I remember her? She never wore a SenseCam, of course, but like me, she wrote a diary. This is 1946, January the 16th. The morning I spent in bed with just a fleeting visit to the NAFI. Is that how you say it? N-A-A-F-I? Prior to afternoon duty. Reported to control, but left quite soon to make inquiries about my stolen bicycle. Was issued with a new one. Met Fred on my way back. He jumped out of 83 Squadron crew room window to tell me he's taking me to a pantomime in Lincoln next week. So he is he? These air crew. Wrote to Clay. Given permission to go to a dance. Met Fred and danced with him. I wish I knew who all these men were. There are so many men she talks about. Some of them were killed. Some of them I remember
When I was a kid, she saw one of her boyfriends land in the plane at the airfield in front of her and burst into flames. These words summon up memories of a mother I never knew, long before I was born. Just think how much more this will happen if we all start life-logging. But if Emma Berry is right, there's a cost to remembering too much. Being able to forget may be healthy. Jim McGaw certainly thinks so. He's been studying three people who have what he calls hypothymestic syndrome, the uncanny ability to remember their own life in fantastic detail. He told me about the first of them, a woman called Jill Price, whom he's been studying for the last 8 years.
She in particular has a very, very strong autobiographical memory, which means that she can remember in detail any specific day of her life after roughly the day, age of 10 to 12, something of that kind. And she remembers not only the details of her personal life, but she remembers whatever public events were prominent on that particular day. So if I ask her what happened on, let's say, May 12th, 1993, she'll say, first of all, the day of the week, and then she'll say something about what she did that day. And if there was a significant public event, a plane crash, a train crash, a war, she'd be able to give the details surrounding it.
And she always gets those dates right, does she?
Always gets them right.
You say she came to you for help. You imply that she was suffering from this memory.
Well, she in particular claims that it causes her a lot of anxiety, that it's a problem because if she thinks of the date today, then she'll think of the date last year and the year before and the year before. And in the consequence of flipping back on these dates, she'll come across a day in which something terrible happened. And that's very disturbing to her. And it's also disturbing to her because she claims it is uncontrollable. That is, once she starts the flipping back in time, it occupies her, and it continues to do so for some time.
Would you like to have a much better memory?
I don't think that there would be an advantage for any of us to have a much better memory unless we are memory deficient. That is, unless we have Alzheimer's disease or brain injury or something of that kind. I just don't see any evidence of having a stronger memory than ordinary as being particularly advantageous. Now, you might think it would be, but in the case of these people, none of the three, there's no Nobel Prize winner in the bunch. These are just people who have ordinary lives. There doesn't seem to be any selective advantage. And of course, today, we don't have to rely on our memories so much anymore because we have printed material, we have BlackBerries, we have PCs, we have Google, we have all kinds of aids that can get information for us, so we don't have to load up our memories.
PCs, Google, the internet? We've been talking about memory so far as though it were an entirely private affair, but increasingly, it seems, people are actually choosing to put themselves on display, to join in making collective shared memories, and that could be changing the nature of memory itself.
I put a photo online recently of my brother's wedding, which was 6 years ago, which is his wife throwing the bouquet on Whitstable Beach for a bunch of people. And one of the women in the group is actively running away from the bouquet, which we found quite funny.
Chris Locke used to lecture in electronic communications, and now he works in the industry. He's fascinated by the rapid rise in social networking sites, sites like Facebook and MySpace, where people maintain friendships, share photos and experiences, and comment on each other's memories over the internet.
What's happened is underneath that photo, a whole group of people in the photo have commented on what's happening. You know, have actually commented on what the events were. And it turns out that the woman running away from the bouquet was already married and therefore didn't really feel like she needed to be in it. But also, more importantly, another rather forlorn-looking man standing on the outside of the group has pointed out that he was actually hoping that his girlfriend would join the group because he was about to propose, and she didn't. They did get married a year later, so it is quite a good story. But, you know, what we got is all of the people in the photo effectively bringing their memory in and bringing some kind of remembrance that really built the narrative of the photo out very strongly.
Does it change what it means to be a person?
I think it makes you a more connected person. I think what happens is a lot of the ephemera that usually happened around common memories and common media starts to be encased in a digital form. So you're no longer in isolation, and more importantly, your memories and your digital artifacts are no longer in isolation. You're part of a connected social web.
You've been very positive and optimistic about all the changes going on and those to come.
Is there anything that you fear in what's happening with these sites and with the increasing ability to store information?
I think it is an incredibly democratizing medium. I think we're seeing this on a level more and more and more. You know, what this has enabled people to do is not only connect with their personal memories, but genuinely to affect the media and the way that the media reports events. You know, this has to be something which is, on a very basic human level or on a very basic community level, a massive positive.
A street protest in China over suspected abuses by the police. The demonstrators are dispersed, and one's apparently dragged away after a beating. This grainy video was posted on an internet site called witness.org, designed to change who has the power over public memory. It's the brainchild of the musician Peter Gabriel. I went to see him at his house and studios in Wiltshire, and there I had a bit of a shock to my own memory. Well, I'm here at Real World, and the odd thing is, it's all coming back to me. I came here once before, must be maybe 15 years ago, to make a CD-ROM with Peter Gabriel. Just seeing these buildings, a big old mill and the gardens around it, I haven't thought about that for years. Oh, making this programme is making me feel very strange. Right, I better go and introduce myself and find Peter. Although he's best known as a musician and a founder member of the band Genesis, he's also been a social entrepreneur, fascinated by the interaction between technology and society. Mobile phones that can take video may seem like just a trendy marketing gimmick, but for Peter Gabriel, they can be a tool to resist oppression.
What amazed me was that people could suffer extraordinary hardship, pain and abuses, and then the oppressors often would be able to bury the story, deny it, and forget it. And it seems people have been getting away with murder for many, many years. So video evidence was hugely important. So I made a proposal then to the Reebok Foundation for a couple of years, and I didn't really get anywhere. And then the Rodney King incident happened in America, and people suddenly thought, OK, I get it. You have a camera in the right place at the right time, and you can actually change what happens.
You can change what happens. But are we ready for such change? Not all the effects of hyper-shared memory may be so positive or clear-cut. Deb Roy, the man filming the first 3 years of his son's life, says lots of potential questions have not yet even been asked.
What happens when a family makes recordings and then the parents divorce? And now there is some kind of conflict between people who had consented to being recorded together, and who owns that data and what uses may it be put to? I think those are the questions. You know, what can you do with the data more than who has it and who has access to it is how do you put restrictions on what can be done with it? And we really are in new terrain here. Probably most people, when you pull out a video camera in a social setting, don't really think twice about where that data might go and who might see it. Or for that matter, when people post videos and photographs on Facebook or wherever, their favorite social networking site, they don't think through in the future who might access it and for what.
Nigel Shadbolt at Southampton says this is the toughest issue. Our rapidly changing technology has outpaced our social and legal systems. That raises new questions about the security and privacy of this data about ourselves, even when it's apparently stored under lock and key.
If you think of areas where there is increasing amounts of information about individuals, for example, biobanks, you know, where people are collecting or governments are collecting DNA samples, for example, you can put around that quite strong regulation about how that material may be used. And so in Sweden, for example, where this process has been underway for some time, there are very strong safeguards about how that material can be used. Then you get a high-profile incident, the murder of a famous politician, and the outcry is such that the data is used to find, locate and prosecute that individual. Or similarly, the same data was used to identify victims of the tsunami. And whatever is said at the time, a degree of force majeure can come into effect either on behalf of a state or some higher interest. So if I'm recording all of my personal data, and I can imagine I've got perfect ownership over that and I'm entitled, it's mine, it's my family's. If I'm involved in some kind of public health scare, I might have been associated with spreading some disease. I imagine the authorities will have some manner or means to get an injunction to look at that material.
In my own lifetime, I may be able to keep some control, but what about when I'm gone? Or should I say, when my body is gone? For increasingly, there may be rather a lot of me around in the form of recorded memories, even after death.
People talked about the idea of these devices providing a form of digital...
I'm a little haunted by what Nigel Shadbolt told me earlier.
...bringing back to life people who have been lost.
And that may not be so far off. Peter Gabriel is already working on a project called Memory.com. He can't say too much yet for commercial reasons, but for him, as for me, this is clearly something of profound personal significance.
I have two aging parents. My dad's actually 96. And I know there'll be lots of things about him that I would love to retain, and I think we don't have very good systems given the technology at our disposal. So we've tried to start thinking through some of the ways that people might want to, tools they might want for preserving themselves and for other people to be able to sort of come in and share. So we call it at the moment the first social network for the dead. But
is it mostly for the living, or is it for the... I mean, obviously it's for the living, but do you think it's mostly important for the person who's going to die to be able to put all this stuff down, or is it more important for others who love them to do it?
I think both. For example, you may want to send out birthday messages beyond the grave, all sorts of things that you could program into the future.
Would we be blurring the difference between life and death if we did it really well?
All these questions are going to come up, and I don't know the answers. A lot of baby boomers now are starting to think about mortality, and most of my age group have witnessed the first crop going.
Indeed, me too.
Yeah, so it's something to think about. And actually, I think all cultures that have death present within their culture seem to live life more fully. That somehow, by avoiding death, you avoid life. So perhaps this is a way to, another way to deal with death.
This is February the 10th, 1964. I bought two packets of Beatle cards for Caroline and four for me. I now have 42 altogether, of which, worse luck, six are swaps. I made a super case for them with the signatures forged by me on it, and I keep all the photographs in it. Now, I remember those. They were the Beatle cards. They came with chewing gum, and we just threw the gum away. We bought chewing gum every day on the way home from school. This day, obviously, I bought more than one, and then just threw the gum away and collected the pictures. That's possibly the driving force behind a lot of this. It's so frightening to think that our memories just go away, that we live a day and then it's gone. And all of these things are attempts to kind of hang on to who we are. So that websites, having my own website is one way, but also MySpace and Bebo and all these other things, and Flickr and people putting up their all their pictures and their videos, and all of these things are a kind of safety against the fear of losing who you have been, your past self.